Akbar Chalene's gigantic computer fuck-up, first universal cybernetic kinetic ultra-micro programmer, was basically a rather sophisticated form of the standard self-programming algorithmic logic machine of the time. The name was one of his whimsies. Fuck-up's real claim to uniqueness was a programmed stochastic process where it could throw an I Ching hexagram, reading a random open circuit as a broken yin line and a random closed circuit as a full yang line until six such lines were round. Consulting its memory banks, where the whole tradition of I Ching interpretation was stored, and then cross-checking its current scannings of the day's political, economic, meteorological, astrological, astronomical, and technological eccentricities, it would provide a reading of the hexagram, which, to Hagbard's mind, combined the best of the scientific and occult methods for spotting oncoming trends. On March the 13th, the stochastic pattern spontaneously generated hexagram 23, breaking apart. Fuck-up then interpreted:
"This traditionally unlucky sign was cast by Atlantean scientist priests shortly before the destruction of their continent and is generally connected with death by water. Other vibrations link it to earthquakes, tornadoes, and similar disasters, and to sickness, decay, and morbidity as well. The first correlation is with the unbalance between technological acceleration and political retrogression, which has preceded Earth-wide at ever-widening danger levels since 1914, and especially since 1964. The breaking apart is fundamentally the schizoid and schismatic mental fugue of lawyer politicians attempting to administrate a worldwide technology whose mechanisms they lack the education to comprehend and whose gestalt trend they frustrate by breaking apart into obsolete Renaissance nation-states. World War III is probably imminent, and considering the advances in chemical biological warfare in conjunction with the sickness vibrations of hexagram 23, the unleashing of plague or nerve gas or both is as probable as thermonuclear overkill. General prognosis? Many megadeaths. There is some hope for avoidance of the emerging pattern with prompt action of correct nature. The probability of such avoidance is 0.17 to 0.05. No blame."
"My ass, no blame,"
Hagbard raged, and rapidly reprogrammed Fuck-up to read off to him its condensed psychobiographies of the key figures in world politics and the key scientists in chemobiological warfare. The first dream came to Dr. Charles Mocenigo on February the 2nd, more than a month before Fuck-up picked up the vibrations. He was, as usual with him, aware that he was dreaming, and the vision of a gigantic pyramid which seemed to walk or lumber about meant nothing and quickly vanished. Now he seemed to be looking at an enlargement of the DNA double helix. It was so detailed that he began searching it for the bonding irregularities at every 23rd angstrom. To his surprise, they were missing. Instead, there were other irregularities at each 17th angstrom.
"What the devil?"
he asked, and the pyramid returned, seeming to speak and saying,
"Yes, the devil."
He jolted awake with a new concept, Anthrax Leprosy Mu, coming into consciousness, and began jotting in his bedside pad.
"What the hell is this Desert Door project?"
the president had asked once, scrutinizing the budget.
Germ warfare,
an aide explained helpfully.
They started with something called Anthrax Delta, and now they've worked their way up to something called Anthrax Mu, and...
His voice was drowned out by the rumble of paper shredders in the next room. The president recognized the characteristic sound of the cesspool cleaners hard at work.
Never mind,
he said.
Those things make me nervous.
He scribbled a quick okay next to the item and went on to deprived children, which made him feel better.
Here,
he said.
This is something we can cut.
He forgot everything about Desert Door until the Fernando Poo crises.
Suppose, just suppose,
he asked the Joint Chiefs on March the 29th.
I go on the tube and threaten all out thermonuclear heck, and the other side doesn't blink. We got something that'll scare them even more.
The JCs exchanged glances. One of them spoke tentatively.
Out near Las Vegas,
he said,
we have this Desert Door project that seems to be way ahead of the comrades in BB and BC. That's biological, bacteriological, and biological chemical.
The president explained to the vice president, who was frowning.
It has nothing to do with BB guns.
Turning his attention back to the military men, he asked,
what have we got specifically that will curdle Ivan's blood? Well, there's anthrax leprosy mu. It's worse than any form of anthrax, more deadly than bubonic, and anthrax and leprosy all in one lump. As a matter of fact...
The general who was speaking smiled grimly at the thought.
Our evaluation suggests that with death being so quick, the psychological demoralization of the survivors, if there are any survivors, will be even worse than in thermonuclear exchange with maximum dirty fallout. By golly,
the president said.
By golly, we won't just use that out in the open. My speech will just talk bomb. But we'll leak it to the boys in the Kremlin that we've got this anthrax gimmick in cold storage, too. By gosh, you just wait and see them back down.
He stood up, decisive, firm, the image he always projected on television.
I'm going to see my speechwriters right now. Meanwhile, arrange that the brain responsible for this anthrax pie gets a raise. What's his name?
He asked, over his shoulder, going out the door.
Masanigo, Dr. Charles Masanigo. A raise for Dr. Charles Masanigo,
the president called from the hallway.
Masanigo?
The vice president asked thoughtfully.
Is he a WAP?
Don't say WAP,
the president shouted back.
How many times do I have to tell you don't say WAP or kike or any of those words anymore?
He spoke with some asperity, since he lived daily with a dread that someday the secret tapes he kept of all Oval Room transactions would be released to the public. He had long ago vowed that if that day ever came, the tapes would not be full of expletive deleted or characterization deleted. He was harassed, but still he spoke with authority. He was, in fact, characteristic of the best type of dominant male in the world at this time. He was 55 years old, tough, shrewd, unburdened by the complicated ethical ambiguities which puzzle intellectuals, and had long ago decided that the world was a mean son of a bitch in which only the most cunning and ruthless can survive. He was also as kind as was possible for one holding that ultra-Darwinian philosophy, and he genuinely loved children and dogs, unless they were on the site of something that had to be bombed in the national interest. He still retained some sense of humour, despite the burdens of his almost godly office. And although he had been impotent with his wife for nearly 10 years now, he generally achieved orgasm in the mouth of a skilled prostitute within 1.5 minutes. He took amphetamine pep pills to keep going on his grueling 20-hour day, the result that his vision of the world was somewhat skewed in a paranoid direction, and he took tranquilizers to keep from worrying too much, with the result that his detachment sometimes bordered on the schizophrenic. And most of the time, his innate shrewdness gave him a fingernail grip on reality. In short, he was much like the rulers of Russia and China. In Central Park, the squirrel woke again as a car honked loudly in passing. Muttering angrily, he leapt to another tree and immediately went back to sleep. At the all-night Bickford's restaurant on 72nd Street, a young man named August Personage left a phone booth after making an obscene call to a woman in Brooklyn. He left behind one of his "This phone booth reserved for Clark Kent" stickers. In Chicago, 1 hour earlier on the clock, but the same instant, the phone booth closed. A rock group called Clark Kent and his Supermen began a revival of rock around the clock. Their leader, a tall black man with a master's degree in anthropology, had been known as El Hajj Starker Lee Muhammad during a militant phase a few years earlier. And his birth certificate said Robert Pearson on it. He was observing his audience and noted that bearded young white cat Simon was with a black woman, as usual. A fetish Pearson Muhammad Kent could understand by reverse psychology, since he preferred white chicks himself. Simon, for once, was not entranced by the music. Instead, he was deep in conversation with the girl and drawing a diagram of a pyramid on the table to explain what he meant.
Crown Point,
Pearson heard him say over the music. And listening to Rock Around the Clock 10 years earlier, George Dawn had decided to let his hair grow long, smoke dope and become a musician. He had succeeded in two of those ambitions. The statue of Tlaloc in the Museum of Anthropology, Mexico, D.F., stared inscrutably upward toward the stars. And the same stars glittered above the Caribbean, where the porpoise named Howard sported in the waves. The motorcade passes the Texas School Book Depository and moves slowly toward the triple underpass. At the sixth-floor window, Lee Harvey Oswald sights carefully through the Cacano Manlicher. His mouth is dry, desert dry, but his heartbeat is normal, and no sweat stands out on his forehead. This is the moment, he is thinking, the one moment transcending time and hazard, heredity and environment, the final test and proof of free will and of my right to call myself a man. In this moment now, as I tighten the trigger, the tyrant dies, and with him all the lies of a cruel, mendacious epoch. It is a supreme exaltation, this moment, and this knowledge. And yet his mouth is dry, dust dry, dry as death, as if his salivary glands alone rebelled against the murder, which his intellect pronounced necessary and just. Now, he recalls the military formula, BASS, B-A-S-S, breathe, aim, slack, squeeze. He breathes, he aims, he slacks. He starts to squeeze as a dog barks suddenly, and his mouth falls open in astonishment as three shots ring out, obviously from the direction of the grassy knoll and triple underpass.
Son of a bitch,
he said softly as a prayer, and he began to grin, a rictus not of omnipotence such as he had expected, but of something different and unexpected, and therefore better. Omniscience. That smirk appeared in all the photos during the next day and a half before his own death. A sneering smile that said so clearly that none dared to read it. I know something you don't know. That grimace only faded Sunday morning when Jack Ruby pumped two bullets into Lee's frail, fanatic body. And its secret went with him to the grave. But another part of the secret had already left Dallas on Friday afternoon's TWA whisper jet to Los Angeles, travelling behind the business suit, grey hair, and only moderately sardonic eyes of a little old man who was listed on the flight manifest as Frank Sullivan. This is serious, Peter Jackson was thinking. Joe Malik wasn't on a paranoid trip at all. The non-committal expressions of Muldoon and Goodman did not deceive him at all. He had long ago learned the black art of surviving in a white world, which is the art of reading not what was on a face, but what is behind the face. The cops were worried and excited, like any hunters on the track of something both large and dangerous. Joe was right about the assassination plot, and his disappearance and the bombing were part of it. And that meant George Dawn was in danger too. And Peter liked George, even if he was a snotty kid in some ways and an annoying ass-licker about the race thing like most young white radicals. Mad Dog Texas, Peter thought. That sure sounds like a bad place to be in trouble. Almost 50 years before, a habitual bank robber named Harry Pierpont approached a young convict in Michigan City Prison and asked him,
"Do you think there might be a true religion?"
"But why is George Dawn screaming while Saul Goodman is reading the memos?"